honestly say I'm happy to be up here, especially because sitting on that row, I just had to hold my breath. We were just squeezed in, and I thought I was going to die, and it's good to see. I thought, hurry up there and call me up here. I got to have a breath. And it's so good to see old friends and new friends and people that know CPR, because you are on call right now. If I fall out, one of you come up here and help me. Aaron told me he wanted me to be myself, but that's the last person that I want to be right now. I want to tell this story. For 10 years, Satan has really fought to keep this story down. And y'all just don't know how he really has fought to keep it down. And I hope now, because of you people here last week, y'all just really overflooded my soul. And I hope now, with y'all's help and God's help, that we can just give Satan a mighty blow right now.
Amen.
I worked at the City of LaGrange Police Department for 4 years before I went to Troop County, and they had a task force that Gene Jones, and he's here today, he gave me a job. And our job was to run the interstates and the roads and enforce the speed laws and DUI drivers, get them off the road, and hopefully, you know, get down on the people that were getting hurt and killed in accidents. On March the 1st, 1987, it was my first day on the second shift, and I was on Interstate 185. And, you know, that was such a barren interstate back then that I did not really like to even work it, but we had to work it. And about 6:30, I had already written about 4 tickets, and pretty good tickets. I mean, the average speed was about 85 miles an hour. And I thought, I'm going to just take a break right now and go to dinner. And I started to crank up the car, and I had a back radar gun on, and I heard it hum. And radar, sometimes you don't really have to watch it. You can just listen for the pitch. And it was pretty high, and so I knew that somebody was coming up behind me pretty fast. And I looked at the display, and it was 93 miles an hour. And I thought, I just can't let this guy run down this road this fast, and I guess I'll pull over one more stop before I go to dinner. So I turned on my blue lights, and I got behind him, and he promptly pulled over. I walked up to the car, and it was a young man, about 29 years old, and I said, sir, you're going a little too fast. I need to see your driver's license. Well, he pulls out his wallet and he starts to thumb through it, and then he opens up the glove box and he looks under the seat and in the back seat and looking everywhere, and he says, I just can't find my license. And he opens his wallet back up, and I see this yellow sheet of paper. And any police officer in here knows what color yellow, that color yellow that I saw in his wallet, and it was a ticket. And I said, sir, you don't have a license, do you? And he said, no, I don't. And he handed me these tickets. And he had just gotten out of an Atlanta jail for speeding and driving without a license. And he handed me the tickets. And he said, I just got out of jail this morning, and they told me that I could drive on these tickets. I said, sir, I don't think that they would have put you in jail for driving without a license and given you a ticket and then told you to go back out and drive. But he was so nice, and he was being so cooperative. He said, it's a mistake, and they said they're going to get cleared up, and if you'll just, you know, give me a warning and let me go. And I said, no, sir, I can't do that, but I tell you what, let me go back to my car, and let me call this in, and let me just see if we can clear this up. And I turned to go back to my car, and he said, no, don't, it's suspended. Well, I was halfway between my car and his car, and I thought, you know, back in 87, we didn't have pepper gas, and we didn't have mace, and usually I had a nightstick, and if I knew I was going to make an arrest, I would carry the nightstick with me just in case. And I stood there thinking, should I go back? Should I just go back to my car? Should I just get him out? And I thought, you know, he's been relatively honest, and he's been cooperative. So I walked back to his car, and I opened his door, and I said, we're going to have to go down to the station, and we'll get this cleared up. And you work with me, and I'll be happy to work with you. And I opened his door, and he got out, and he walked with me back to my patrol car, and he was very cooperative. And I told him that I needed to make sure he had no weapons on him, so he put his hands on the hood of my patrol car, and I did pat him down. He had no weapons, and we were talking. And when it got to the point where he said, what are you going to do with my car? I said, well, we're going to have to tow it in. And the minute he heard that his car was going to be towed in, he instantly changed into another person. And he was saying, no, don't tow my car in. I'm thinking, what is the big deal about the car? And I explained to him that I couldn't leave it on an interstate like 185. He would come back and the tires would all be off. All the windows would be busted out. You know, we couldn't be responsible for that. And we had a policy that it needed to be towed. Well, things just turned from good to worse, and he just got more aggressive, and he kept pulling his hands off the hood of the car, and I kept placing them back on. And I reached to open the door, the back door. I was just going to hurry up, put him in the car before things got worse. And I guess it was an old city habit from working with LaGrange Police Department that whenever we worked on Hamilton Road over the top, there would be two of us officers in the car. And sometimes we just have people run up and jump in the back seat and start hollering about something and scare you half to death and you wouldn't know what was up. And so I got in the habit a long time ago to just lock the doors. And when I let go of him to pull that door open and it was locked, I was in trouble right then. So I tried to keep one hand on him and I reached up with the other hand and opened the front door and hit the power locks, but it was just enough for me to turn from him. When I turned back around, he hit me in the chest. And he tried to run past me, and I grabbed him. And, you know, we fought again through both lanes of that interstate. And we were on the ground, and we were rolling, and we were fighting. And I was trying to restrain him. And he instantly changed. He was saying things like, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to blow your head off. I'm going to leave you here dead. You know, you're going straight to hell. I'm going to kill you. And it was just, I knew that I was not just fighting to restrain him. I knew that I was fighting for my life. And somehow we ended up back over by the back of my car, and I remember we were down on the ground, and I managed to get one of his arms up behind his back, and I had it so far back. And usually, you know, I would think that an arm hold like that would incapacitate a person, and I had it so far back that I thought I was going to dislocate his shoulder. And I, with my other hand, I was grabbing my handcuffs, which were behind my back, and I was going to handcuff him. And he just kept struggling, and I kept pulling his arm up behind his back even further and further. And with his other hand, he started tugging on my gun. We had thumb break holsters, and I knew that he was pulling on my gun, but I really didn't think that he could get it out. And I thought, if I can just get a handcuff on him, then I got him. Well, he's grabbing my gun, and he says, I'm going to get your gun, and I'm going to blow your brains out. He's saying all these things about what he's going to do, and I'm just frantically trying to get my handcuffs on him. And I hear this stretching kind of a rip noise, and my holster had torn. And he came out with a gun, and we both came to our feet, and I was looking down the barrel of that .357. And he said, now I'm going to blow your head off. And he had this smile on his face. And I'll just never forget the joy that he took in that. And I knew that he meant it. I knew that he was going to do it. And instantly I remembered something that I had learned years ago in police academy about a revolver, that if the cylinder can't advance, then he can't fire. And I thought, you know, he may kill me, but I'm not going to stand here and let him. And I reached up and I grabbed the cylinder of that gun and I held it as tight as I could. And I could see that he's trying to pull it, but it wouldn't turn. And I just have to believe there was an angel's hand over my hand that held that cylinder. And I'm twisting that gun and trying to get it out of his wrist, and I'm thinking, I almost have it. I knew I almost had it. And I'm looking him right in the face. And I managed to get the gun down. And I'm looking him in the eyes. And I saw the deepest, darkest nothing in those eyes. That for a minute, I just had to look. And if you've ever seen someone that maybe was living with Satan, you'll see that darkness in their eyes. And I remember that I'd seen him and talked to him before. And I did not see it there. But I saw it then, and in that instant that I was looking in his eyes, I heard a great explosion. And I, next thing I know, I'm being thrown backwards through the air, and I twist around, and I start to go to the pavement, and I'm landing on my face, and I try to catch myself. And that didn't work too good, and I remember I landed on my face, and I rolled over, and I'm thinking, what happened? I didn't feel anything at that time, but I'm thinking, well, he must have shot me. And I'm laying there and I'm thinking, I can't believe it. He shot me. I guess I'm shot because I'm laying on the ground. And I'm laying there and I'm kind of spread eagle with my legs open and I try to get up and I couldn't. It felt like I was just nailed to that pavement. And he starts to walk up and I see him walking up and he's got this biggest smile on his face. And he's holding that gun and he's saying what he's going to do now and he's going to empty that gun into me. And I'm thinking he's walking right up between my legs and I'm thinking he's going to walk right up on my stomach. And I think, you know, I'm getting mad now. He shot me and I am getting mad. And I couldn't get up and I thought, oh, I don't know what to do, but I'm not just going to lay here. I'm not going to let him finish me this way. And he walked so close and I managed to roll my hips up and I kicked him right between the legs and he went down. He went down hard. And I remember thinking that then I realized that I was laying in the middle of the road and my head was on that center line and he was laying right beside me. And I thought, how ironic that he shot me and we're both laying out here helpless. And I don't know how long we laid there. But eventually I heard him mumbling and he got to his knees and he crawled on all fours. And he crawled right up to the side of my head and put the gun right up to the side of my head. And I could feel his breath on the side of my face and he said, now you're going to see what it feels like to die. He said, I'm going to pull this trigger and this bullet's going to go through your head and you're going to hear the explosion and you're going to feel this bullet go through your head and you're going to feel your brains go out the side of your head. And he went on and on and on and I finally didn't know why he didn't do it and I finally just said, why don't you just do it? And I closed my eyes and I waited and waited and thought, what is it going to be like? What is it going to be like to hear that and to instantly die or be gone or lay here and suffer? And I closed my eyes and I laid there and nothing happened. And he got up and he looked at me and he kicked me in the side and he went over and looked in my car. And I guess he was looking for his tickets. You know, I had his tickets and it used to be that if I had a driver's license and I was going to issue a citation, I would stick it in the front of my gun belt. For some reason, when he gave me his tickets, I folded them up and I stuck them behind my back in my gun belt. Well, of course, I was laying on them, and I don't know if that's what he was looking for, but he went to the car and he opened my door and he was looking for something and he got mad and slammed it shut and turned back around and looked at me laying there and pointed the gun at me again, and I'm thinking, why didn't he shoot me? I'm thinking, well, this joker thinks that I'm dead. And I'm like, I have just pulled off a great caper. He thinks I'm dead. And I really did believe that I thought that I could just lay there and be still, and he thought that I was dead. And I thought, be still, don't move, don't smile, try not to breathe, and maybe he'll leave and you can make it. And he started to walk to his car, and he turned around, pointed the gun at me again, and I thought, just be still, be still. And he got in his car and he left and I thought, thank you, Lord. I can't believe that I'm still alive. I don't know why he didn't pull that trigger. I don't know why he didn't empty the gun. I knew that he intended to. I had no way of knowing at the time what was going on with that. Well, you know, we had these radios and Huck, you remember them. They had a half circle on them and you would put it on your gun belt and you'd twist it around and they were supposed to pop right off. And I don't know what was up with mine, that I could twist it all the way around. I could never get that radio off. It wouldn't come off. I finally had to just take it out of the case and use it. Well, I'm laying there in the road, and I'm trying to get up, and I can't get up. And I'm thinking, what can I do? And I look over there, and there's my radio. You know, we were across both lanes of that interstate. How that radio came off, you know, I don't know how it came off. How it came off where it was right there by my right arm, I don't know. I don't know. And I see that radio and I'm thinking, I don't believe it. And I kind of just stretch over there and I get it to me and I'm thinking, I'm at least 17 miles from Troop County Sheriff's Office. I know they're not going to hear me. And all day long, Bibb County was on the same frequency that we were. Jimmy Jones was on the radio and he's here today. I'd have to repeat myself 100 times just to call in a traffic stop. A lot of times there was so much traffic that I would just wait till afterwards to call him in because he couldn't hear me and I couldn't hear him. And I'm thinking, I'm so far out, I've waited so long to charge these batteries. I know he's not going to hear me. Well, I just take a deep breath and I think, you know, the worst thing that they need to do is hear a hysterical white woman laying in the road, "Oh, I need some help." So I took a deep breath and I planned what I was going to say, and I took all my strength and I tried to raise my shoulders up, and I said, "D20 Troop County, I've been shot and I need help." And instantly the radio was just so quiet. And Jimmy, I know that somebody asked him before, and he said it was a hectic day, that everything was going on, but there was a quietness at that sheriff's office in that radio room when he heard that. And instantly I fell back to the ground, and I was so exhausted. But I could hear on my car radio that help was coming. And instantly I started to feel like I was on fire, and I'm thinking, gosh, I guess that bullet, the flash from the muzzle, must have caught my clothes on fire. And for the first time, I look over and I look at my left arm. And you know, I'd been a cop for a long time, and I've seen a lot of broken bodies, and I've seen a lot of things I hope y'all never see. But what I saw, with bones sticking out, and by then it was getting dark, and you know, bones sticking out and muscle and blood, and my hand was twisted back in a way that it was almost fascinating at first to see a hand in that position, because I knew there was no way that that could have been. And I didn't know if it was still attached. I didn't know if I was going to make it. I just knew that I wasn't going to look at it again if I needed any chance to get out of that road. Well, then I turned my head and I looked to the right, and it was kind of on a pretty good straightaway, and I can see for miles down the interstate. And I'm thinking, my car's on the side of the road with these powerful strobes, and people are going to come up and look at my car, and I'm kind of ahead of the car. They're not going to look where they're going, and I'm going to get run over. And then I started to imagine, what would it be like for a tractor trailer to come down that road and for me to just lay there and wait for him to run over me, and I could scream all I want to, and he wouldn't hear me. And I would know it from 2 miles away, and I would know it from 2 feet away, and I would know it when he hit me. And you know, a terror went over me that was unbelievable. And I thought, so I'm going to die. This is what it's like to die. And it was unbelievable, the fear, and to finally look death in the face and say, "This is death, and it's coming for you." And for me to think, no, you know, death is for sick people and death is for old people. And I was so terrified of that. And when I finally realized, well, Joy, you are going to die, whether you want to or not, this is a doorway that you're either going to be pulled through or you're going to walk through. And it doesn't matter if you want to die or not, that you are. And when I realized that, I thought, well, what does that mean that I'm going to die? And from terror, I went to instant joy. I knew what that meant. I knew that that meant that in just a minute, I was going to stand before the Lord God Almighty, and I was going to see Jesus. And if anybody had driven by me at that time and saw me, they would have kept driving, because I had the biggest smile on my face. My arm's blown off, and I'm covered in blood, and I know I was rejoicing. And I felt that there was a light around me. A beautiful sheltering light was around me, and I tried so hard to see it with my physical eyes, but I couldn't. But it was there. And there was a peace and a love that I will never forget. And I hope that y'all will live to see somebody go through that, because it is the most beautiful thing that has ever happened to me. And you know, sometimes now I thank the Lord that He let me live through death like that, because I will never fear death again. And I felt the love of God so strong that I really thought that I was the luckiest person on the face of the earth at that moment. And you know, I don't know, I can't tell you that I feel like my spirit left my body, but I am rejoicing. I'm thinking about standing before God, and I'm about to see Jesus. And suddenly I see a vision, and I see a vision of me laying in a casket at the funeral home, and I see my husband and my family and my friends standing around, and they're boo-hooing, and I'm like, no, I don't want to see this. They don't know. They think that's what happened. That's not what happened. And I am just rejoicing, and my sister Debbie, and she's here today, in that vision I heard her say, the saddest thing is that she had to die in the road like an animal that's been hit. And I'm like, no, they've got to know it's not like that. And suddenly I hear a voice, and it says, Joy, are you sure? And before I could even answer that, you know, I felt a sadness, and I could not even answer it. I was hoping the Lord would just give me a minute to think about it. Lord, this is so good. You're not going to send me back. But instantly, I was back laying in that road. And I could feel that that light was gone around me, but I could still feel the peace and the love of God. And I was filled with such a peace. And I thought, you know, if I die, that is great, because I'm going to see God. And if I live, well, that's great too. And I, right then, I realized there's no way I'm going to lose in this situation, because I can either die or live. And there is nothing to fear again. And you know, right after that, I felt hands under my arms pulling me out of the road. And I did not see anybody this whole time. And I'm looking around. I'm thinking God sent an angel down to pull me out of the road. And I'm trying to see him. And he pulls me up against my back tire in my car. And suddenly he opens my car door, and he's on the radio screaming, officer's been hurt. And Jimmy and some other officers are trying to tell him to get off the radio. And I don't know if they knew where he was and who he was. And I'm trying to tell him I already called in. And I'm trying to think, well, if you're an angel, you should have known I already called in. Well, suddenly I noticed that there was a lot of cars that had stopped. And somebody's saying we need a tourniquet. And we need something to wrap around her arm. And I remember seeing a beautiful lady and her husband. They were dressed up so nice. And she lifted up her beautiful dress and she tore her skirt. They were on their way to a formal dinner party in Atlanta. And she tore her skirt and her slip, and she handed it to him. He wrapped it around my arm. And it wasn't long, but Robert Huckleberry, who's sitting in the back now, was first deputy on the scene. And Huck came up, and I just felt a peace. I knew that I was safe then when Huck came up. Well, Huck said, you know, we're going to take care of you. You're going to be all right. And soon, it wasn't long, Gene Jones drove up. And I knew that there was a policy that we couldn't transport people in the back of patrol cars. And you know, I thought, Sheriff, don't argue with me now, brother. Just, I said, Sheriff, you need to take me to the hospital now. And I don't know what he was listening to, but he hesitated and he said, pick her up and put her in my car. And you know, there couldn't have been a faster, safer driver than Gene Jones at that time. And they put me in the back of his car, and boy, we took off. And I don't think a jet airplane could outrun Gene Jones that day. But there was a guy in the back seat, and he was holding my arm. And you know, I so bad wanted to say, you know, I think if you just turn it a little bit that way, it won't hurt so bad. And, you know, I just couldn't bring myself to say it, because I was so sure he was going to say, lady, you don't have an arm. You know, and I could not bear to hear that. Well, the sheriff got me to the hospital, and when I got there, there was an old doctor and a young doctor, and the old doctor was saying, there's just too much damage. We're just going to have to take our arm off. And I'm like, no, you're not going to take my arm off. I can't live being handicapped like that. You're not going to take it off. And they said there's no pulse. All the arteries and nerves and everything, they're shot. They're cut. And I remember there was an ambulance driver, and she came in, and she had this Doppler amplifier, and she said, let's try this. And they kind of looked at her, and I don't know what happened, but they did. They stuck it inside my arm, and what that would have done, if there had been any kind of pulse or heart rate inside my arm, the amplifier would have picked it up. And they said, well, it's not going to do any good, but let's do it. And they stuck that inside my arm, and you could hear it all over the ER. You could hear that beep, beep, beep. And I thought, oh, thank you, Jesus. I don't know how that happened, but thank you, Lord. And then the older doctor said, let's just take her out to pediatrics and set her arm, and we'll be done with it. And I'm like, that doesn't sound right. And the younger doctor stood up to him and said, no, we've got to fly her out of here. If she stands a chance, I'm going to go call Life Flight, and we're going to fly her out of here. And a helicopter came, and within 30 minutes, I was at Georgia Baptist Hospital. And when that helicopter landed, there was a team of 25 trauma people that met that helicopter, and they took me in. And within 30 minutes, I was in surgery. And that first surgery lasted for 6 hours. And I had a doctor, and he was a Jewish doctor, and I hope that I learned a lot from him. Well, I hope he learned a lot from me. But he said that because of the flash, he couldn't tell muscle from tendon. He couldn't tell vein from artery. Everything was just severed and mangled so bad. And he would try to tie muscle to muscle, and he didn't know what he was doing. There was just so much damage. And he said he would work for 2 hours and stop and think, why am I doing this? I need to just take this arm off. And something would tell him to go on. And he'd go on a little bit longer, and he'd stop. Why am I doing this? She could not stand a chance to keep this arm, but something would tell him to go on. And for 6 hours, he went through that, and he stopped and started and stopped and started. And, you know, when I got out of surgery, it was still touch and go. There was no guarantee whatsoever that I was going to get to keep my arm. And, you know, after that, there was 33 surgeries over a three-year period that I went through. And each surgery, there was no guarantee. The first thing I do in the recovery room is look over and see if I still had my arm. There was never any guarantee. And I had bone taken out of my hip to put in my arm. I had 4 inches of bone taken out of my right leg. I had a skin graft taken from the front of my right thigh. I had a skin graft taken from the back of my left thigh. You know, I just really thought, Lord, what is going on? You know, before I got shot, I thought God really wanted me to have a sound body and a healthy body. And I thought, Lord, how could I be any use to anybody? You know, they've taken bone from my hip. They've taken bone from my leg. They've cut, you know, I wanted to tell people my doctor was Dr. Frankenstein if they ever saw me in a bathing suit. I just couldn't even explain to them what happened without saying, you know, Dr. Frankenstein. But, you know, God really worked with me during that time, and I had a lot of heartache. And you know, I kept telling my doctor that I was going to have my arm, and I was going to use my arm, and I was going to move my fingers. And he said, you know, you're not being realistic. I was inside your arm, and I know how it's hooked up. And I'm not even sure that I do know how it's hooked up, but I saw it, and there's no way it's ever going to work again. And I said, well, it is going to work again. Well, he sent 3 psychiatrists into my room one day to try to tell me what the truth was. And they came in, and they said, Miss Burnham, your doctor asked us to come in because he doesn't feel that you're being realistic about, first of all, your arm. You know, chances are you're not going to keep your arm. Chances are if you keep it, you're never going to be able to use it. And without a shadow of a doubt, you're never going to be a police officer again. I said, well, I think I am. And they said, well, no, you need to be realistic because you're not going to be prepared for when you do lose your arm. And I'm telling you right now, there's no way you're ever going to be a police officer again. I said, well, sir, you don't know me, and you don't know who works with me, but I have more faith in the one that tells me I will than you that tell me I won't. Well, they insisted that I wasn't being realistic and I was going to have some major problems, so I just told them to leave the room, and I kicked them out. And, you know, that really made me mad because I thought, you know, how can I keep going through all these surgeries? And why do y'all make me go to physical therapy? And why am I laying in a hyperbaric chamber for 4 hours a day? Why am I doing all this? If you're telling me there's no hope, then I'm going to check out. I'm not having any more surgeries. I'm not going to physical therapy. I'm not going through all this pain. I have to believe that there is hope. You know, so my doctor didn't like that too much that I kicked him out. And I don't know, I guess they were all 3 wearing identical suits. I guess somebody had to pay for that too. I don't know. But they sent me to a neurologist. And see, he was going to prove to me that my optimism was not concrete. There was no way he wanted me to believe that God could pull me through this. They sent me to a neurologist who took electrodes, and they were on long needles. and he stuck them all through my arm, and he said that he was sticking them into the nerves, and this machine was going to pick up any kind of nerve activity in my arm. Well, he stuck them in. He said, well, your ulna nerve is completely dead. Your median nerve is completely dead. Your radius nerve is completely dead. And this machine does not lie. I said, well, I don't know what to tell you, but it is lying because I know I'm going to move my fingers again. He stuck those needles in a little bit further and cranked that machine up, and it didn't pick up anything. I said, well, you know, I don't know about this, and I don't believe that, but I believe that I'm going to be healed. And I pulled those needles out, and I was in a wheelchair. I rolled myself out in the hall, and I called for somebody to take me back to my room. And, you know, I laid there, and I was so mad, and I was hurt. And I laid there for hours, and I looked at my hand. And, you know, when I first woke up from a surgery, my first surgery, my fingers were straight out like that. After each surgery, you know, we tried to bend them back, and just, you know, I couldn't bend them. After so many surgeries, my hand was just balled up in a fist, and then we'd have to spend hours straightening them out. Well, after I left that neurologist's office, I laid there, and I looked at my hand for about 6 hours. And I'm thinking, how can it be that your brain can tell a finger to move, and it doesn't move? And I looked at it, and I just tried so hard to make those fingers move, and I couldn't. But the next few days, I looked at them and stared at them, and one day I saw my index finger move just a little bit. But whenever I would try to do it, I couldn't make it move. I didn't know how to make those fingers move. And I had to learn all over again, and it's the most frustrating thing to do it and then to forget how you did it and then to train your brain to move your fingers. I spent hours. But by the time I got my finger to move just a tiny, tiny little bit, I had everybody on that floor, nurses, patients, visitors, come here and look at this. And I would try, and it would take all my energy just to move a finger a tiny bit, but I knew that it was coming. And, you know, it did start to come. And you know how it moves now? I can't tell you how it moves now because I went through Bull Caudill's tests, and after all my fingers started moving, they sent me to more tests, and I failed them. And I don't care that I failed them because they're moving. And I don't know how God did that, but I know that He did it. I don't know how they possibly could move because I know the nerves aren't hooked up, but they do move. And, you know, and I don't care how they move. I just know that they do. And, you know, I don't need any more tests to tell me how much damage there is in my arm. And my arm's not normal by any standards, but I kept it. And it does work. It doesn't work perfect, but it does work. And it's a miracle of God that He gave that to me. And I'm going to tell y'all that, you know, I really was into physical fitness before I got shot. And during this time period that I'm losing bone and muscle and veins, you know, they took some veins and muscles out of the inside of my leg. And I was in a 13-hour operation to put that in my arm. And, so many times that they would take bone from me, I would lose it, and I'd have to start over. And, you know, I thought, Lord, by the time this is done, is it going to be worth me keeping this arm? Because I can't run now, I can't play ball, I can't, what can I not do? Everything that I thought was me, I couldn't do anymore. And I thought, Lord, you know, for the 4 years I was out of work, I thought, Lord, how can I go on living? I think I made the wrong choice. I should have just gone when You told me to go. And, you know, I just don't see, Lord, how You can have a purpose for me. And there was a song that Amy Grant recorded, and it's called So Glad. And I played that song over and over and over and over. And in that song, Amy Grant talks about plans that she had made and how she built a kingdom and how God took it all away from her. And she said she was glad. And I said, Lord, 4 years I've been going through these surgeries. And even today, you know, they told me I could have a bone infection today and I could lose my arm. I'm never going to be out of danger of that. And I thought, Lord, how can I keep on living like that? They took everything that I had from my body to try to put it in my arm. And then we had to start going to bone banks and organ donors to get muscle and bone to go in my arm. And I thought, Lord, I don't have anything left to give. And how can I be useful in Your kingdom? And just tell me that there is still a plan for me. And, you know, I just want to tell you the words of this psalm because they are so powerful. And I know people, you have plans and you think God tells you, and I knew God told me to be in law enforcement. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. And I thought that I would retire in law enforcement. And this song goes, I thought I made some mighty plans. I thought I held them in my hand. Then my world began to crumble all away. I tried to build them back again. I couldn't bear to see them end. How it hurt to know you wanted it that way. Long before my plans were made, I know a master plan was laid. With a power that superseded my control. And if that truth could touch my heart, I wouldn't wander from the start. Trying desperately to make it on my own. Now I'm so glad. Glad to find the reason. But I'm happy that you've torn it all away. Once I held it in my hand, it was a kingdom made of sand. And you've blown it all away. I can't believe that I could say that I'm glad. And you know, I did go back into law enforcement. Gene Jones brought me back, and I was a systems manager for just under a year, and then I talked him into putting me back into investigations, and I did that for about 3 more years, and the Lord told me that He wanted me out of law enforcement, and that was scary to me because I said, you know, that's what they were telling me when I was shot, and you helped me come back, and this has got to be what you want me to do, but it wasn't. And, you know, it was scary to know that after all I had been through and all I had done, that the Lord wanted me to give up a career, and that's all I knew for 15 years. That's all I knew. And, you know, I did it, and I was led to District 4 Health Services, and I see there's people that I work with that are here now from District 4, and God led me to such a spiritual circle of friends that if it was not for where God put me, that I could not be here today to share this story with you. And you know, I know that the importance of this story to some of y'all is that you never should fear death again. You know, I'm overjoyed to know that I'm going to die. And I cannot wait to die. And I'm not saying I don't enjoy living because I do with the best of y'all. But you know, God has got something so wonderfully planned for everyone in here. It doesn't matter if you're laying with your head on the center line of the interstate. If you're in a closet. If you're in a desert, when you die, you're instantly going to be surrounded by angels that are going to care for you. And, you know, I only pray that most of y'all are conscious when you die because it's one of the most beautiful, loving things that you're ever going to fear in your life. And, you know, if that's the greatest thing that God gave me, that I don't have to fear death again, I wished I could give it to y'all because you don't have to fear. And I hope that everybody in here that knows me will know that. So when I go again, if it's with a cold, please don't pull me back down here because you don't know what I'm telling you because I do want to go. But you know, the Lord has really shown me that I am a better person now than I was. And it took a long time to realize that. But you know, when we look at men, we look at the measure of a man, we look at what he owns and what he's done and where he's been in his life. But, you know, I know now that when God looks at me, He looks at me from the inside out. And I never could have hoped to be the person that I am now. And I just thank the Lord for this church and for these people that I work with, my new friends, my old friends, that they have encouraged me to where I can tell y'all that I've waited a long time to say this, but what God has done in my life and what I physically end up with. And you know, this was an earthly curse that I chose to worship myself in. And now the Lord has given me a spiritual vessel. And because of what I've gone through and that I can stand here today and I can share anything from God with you guys, I can truly say after 10 years that I am glad.
Amen.
And I thank y'all, and I'm going to pray for this church because I love this church. I love the spirit that's in this church. And I thank y'all that this is the first time since I gave this testimony 2 times, but I was still having surgery and I did not want to give it because I really felt in my heart for God to have shown me the peace and the glory of heaven that I made a wrong choice to choose to go through 33 surgeries and all the bone transplants and everything that I went through. And I was bitter when I said it before, but I am totally filled with the love of God now, and I can tell you that because of y'all in this church, that This was an honor for me to stand up here and tell y'all this story today.
Hey, stay down here, baby. Stay down.